The new Play Aloft modulation is drawing some rave reviews, including our very own Michael Bourne. And we have the playwright here, James Jorsling, who joins us on the WBGO Journal, along with the band leader of the show, saxophonist Jonathan Bechet. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us and congratulations on Aloft modulation.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
So this play is really, you know, I love history. So it's a dive back into history for sure, and it's a real feel. I'm going to let you, James, talk about how this all developed in your mind. You took it from a real-life experience. Tell us how Aloft modulation came about.
Well, it's two things. I think the first thing I always like to say is my love of music, my love of jazz. And I was fortunate enough many years ago to befriend an older gentleman in the gym who told me one day, hey, you know, I used to play the piano for Charlie Parker. And he was Valdo Williams. And he would tell me all these stories about, man, it was just incredible to be around the creation and to be around Coltrane and Miles Davis and Max Roach and all these people. And I think those planted the earliest seeds in my mind about just doing something about artists, musicians building together. And then fast forward to Sam Stevenson wrote a book about a jazz loft, 821 Sixth Avenue, that a photographer, Eugene Smith, documented and recorded reel-to-reel tapes all day long in this loft. And next door to him was a piano player, Hall Overton, who taught classical music by day at Juilliard and had jam sessions all night in the loft with the likes of Thelonious Monk, Pepper Adams, Zoot Sims, Chick Corea, and a whole lot of other people.
And what's great about that is everyone's saying, oh, I would have loved to have been there. You take us there now. So that's exciting. And Jonathan Bechet, you lead the band. Do you feel the presence of those greats when you're, you know, on stage now?
Well, I definitely feel the energy of that time. I think that there's, you know, when the play's happening, there's just like the stage is just so amazing. Like when I walked in for the first time, I had no idea that the set was going to look the way it did. And, you know, you're instantly, you know, just transported into something completely, and you know, we're wearing costumes and stuff like that, which is something that, you know, we don't really like do as jazz musicians, like kind of the whole theater thing. So like you're almost like transported, and you definitely feel the energy of a completely different time in the city of New York. And there's all these characters and there's all these things, and then on top of that, you know, we're actually like improvising music. It's not like a Broadway musical where there's a book and we're reading it and you can pretty much be expected and counted on to read the exact same music. You know, there's like actual improvisation going and none of the performances are the same. And with all this energy and stuff going on, and I think the band is giving the actors energy and the actors are giving us energy. And it's very much like being transported into, you know, 60 years ago, which is crazy to think that it's that long ago now. That's the feeling I get. It's just like I'm not in, you know, 2019. I'm in 1959. I'm on 1963, you know?
And with that improvisation, people can come back and have almost a whole different experience.
Right? Definitely. And I would say that the way we were playing the music, even just during like previews, is like completely different from how we're playing it now. And, you know, it's kind of a magical experience for the actors, I think. And one of the actors is the guy who plays Way. His name's Eric. And he isn't a jazz pianist, but we gave him some basic skeletons to play on piano. And when he first did it, he was real nervous. He was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. I said, listen, man, you're going to be fine. You're going to do a good job. And he's done a really great job. But now he's kind of getting a really cool experience of doing the music, you know, 7 times a week and seeing how every single day is completely different. And sometimes now he's playing some stuff and he doesn't even know if it's going to work or not, but he plays something and it you know, the whole band will just react to it. So, like, I think, like, we had a performance on Saturday during the matinee, and he started playing something so that it doubled up the time. And within half a measure, the rest of the band reacted to it. And, you know, after we finished playing, I just looked over and said, "Did we just blow your mind?" And he just started laughing. He said, "Yes." So I think, yeah, if you were to come see the show, you know, if you were come to see the show on the very first, you know, opening night, and then you to come see it on closing night, at that point, the music wouldn't even sound the same. And I think that is the magic. That's when people talk about the magic in music, or the energy of that time. I think it's because those guys were playing every night, you know, like they're playing every night and they're jamming like all the time. And we're lucky enough that this play is allowing us to actually do that as musicians. It's kind of crazy that it takes like a theater thing to allow us to do the thing that we used to be able to do all the time. But we're playing a set every day, and sometimes on Saturdays we do it twice. And the music is changing, and that's where like the sound, like the band kind of has like a real sound now. And I remember that Adam, the bassist, he said to me, you know, what's funny is by the time this play is over, the actors are going to have more chemistry with each other than most bands in New York do now. And so, you know, it's a really rare experience to see, to be a part of, and for, I think, the audiences to come see musicians who are that tight and to see actors who are that tight. So there's a lot of just like closeness and chemistry happening, and a lot of like listening going on that makes the music sound really unpredictable. And I think that is, to me, what the spirit of that time was just people going and playing and trying stuff and seeing if it goes left or if it goes right. And you're going to get that in this play. And that was the thing that, to me, surprised me the most, was that we were given the freedom to actually do that. It takes a lot of risk to, you know, bring in an actual jazz band and be like, okay, well, we want these tunes, or we want these emotions, we want this vibe. But, you know, other than that, you guys just like decide what it is you think is appropriate. And I was like, okay, if that's really what you want, because people say they want that, and then they get it, and then they're upset. And, you know, each time we would do it when we were rehearsing, you know, and they would say to us, so it's like, oh, you can have, Chris, the director, he'd say to us, you can have more energy, you can have more energy. And I was like, oh, it's going to be pretty loud. He's like, don't worry about that. It can be more energy, more energy. I was like, okay. So then we just keep doing it. And each time we're like waiting for the other shoe to drop, we're just like, okay, this is it. We're going to get it now. And it hasn't happened. And so once we figured out we really did have that kind of freedom to play like those guys played with that kind of freedom, we really have like just like, you know, run amok with it. And I think that if you can't really see that in a lot of other places. So this is a great play for that. And I think that's what I talk about wrapping up, just to say we're being transported, because you're really getting that kind of wildness and that energy and that freedom. And I don't think you see that as much today.
It's too bad Jonathan isn't passionate about a loft modulation.
Yeah, I know.
You know it's just wonderful, yeah, to see it. I mean, to see you guys switch up. You know, I'm there watching, and see, and even you switch up on the horns, and you go to your soprano sax.
Exactly.
Or you'll go to the other one. And just like you said, to see, like even with the piano player, to see him arpeggiating and doing different accents and things like those, mm-hmm. You go, he's kicking with you guys.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. And it is great to see.
Aloft Modulation is presented by American Vicarious, and it's running at the Mezzanine Theater at the ART New York Theater, and that's through October 27th. When it all came together, James, and you finally heard the music with the actual play that you put together, what went through your mind?
It was incredible. It was incredible because, you know, Chris and I talked, and you have an idea in your head.
Let's mention that the director is sitting right behind me, Christopher McElrone, who's a big listener to WBGO, and we appreciate that. And he's directing this play, so continue.
And Chris has been wonderful as a partner in this project the whole way. And the one thing he always encouraged me with was, don't worry about it. We'll just try it. We'll do it. And then he would bring in ideas. I would bring in ideas. And we'd put them together. And, you know, on paper or just us conceptualizing it, you don't know if it's going to work, how it's going to work. You know, we think it's going to work. And then to hear it. And then to watch Chris tinker with it and tell him where they can go further, where they can pull it back, where they can, you know, expand and all those things. The blend is incredible to have. It's like a score, you know, because it's not a musical where anyone is just going to bust out into song or anything like that. But you literally have scenes where music is forming a bed underneath or a layer just within the fabric of the piece.
So take us to the actual stage and the characters involved and how you've meshed this together.
Well, the stage is a wonderful set created by Troy Harry. And it is it captures, so I write this play and I write about two neighboring lofts. And Chris went to the building, looked in the building, and then he decided, well, since it was three floors, how do we get three floors on one stage? And that's what the set conceptualizes. It is three separate floors of this building on one stage. One loft is the photographer's dark room. One loft is the photographer's, I guess, day-to-day residence. And the third loft is the piano player's loft where the musicians jam. And all of that is put together on one stage.
So talk about the character that's based on Eugene Smith.
Well, the character based on Eugene Smith, I call him Myth Williams. And it's about he was a photographer and so much more than a photographer. He was ahead of his time. This was a guy who experimented with shading and burning and doing things that today people might call retouching to a lesser degree. But he, as an artist, did so many things to his pictures, to his concepts. And he developed the concept of the photographic essay, which was, okay, I'm going to pick 8, 10 pictures that tell a story rather than one picture that's left up to somebody to get what they get or not get what they get. And so this photographer, Eugene Smith, who inspired me to make my character Myth Williams, was a guy who was so dogmatic and so focused and so diligent that he left his job, his wife, his kids, his everything, to move into a loft and to just work, focus, and to create his opus.
And much like Louis Armstrong did, he had this vision of being able to record everything.
Everything. Whatever he did, he was obsessive about it. So here's a man who came into this loft and would just cut on reel-to-reel tapes all day long, to the point where, for years, 10 years of this, to the point where when he passed away, there were 2.5 tons worth of tapes and pictures that he left behind.
That's a lot of material to narrow down into a play.
Absolutely.
So how did you do that?
Well, I wanted to talk about two different forms of art. We have the visual art form, which is a photographer who has his vision and has his style and has his own path that he's seeking. But then there is the musical grind. And the thing about both of them, photography is a solo endeavor. You by yourself are taking these pictures. You by yourself are in a dark room. But then musically, no matter how much you practice in woodshed by yourself, the goal is to build and to play with other musicians. And one of the beauties of jazz was and still is, I think, at its highest form, it's not tracks of people recording them separately and individually. It's you prepare yourself and get yourself the best you can be to then get amongst other musicians who hopefully can challenge you and push you, and you play together and that collective can just hopefully ascend. But there is an insecurity to that. Are you good enough? Are you keeping up with your peers? How will the collective be received? Will you thrive in that collective or will you diminish in that collective? And so it was really about trying to matter through your art. How can you be the best you can be, claim your territory up on a platform, up on a mountain, high, wherever it is, whatever it is that you do through art? So that was my goal, to have two separate artists woodshedding and grinding in this loft.
We're speaking with the playwright James Josling and also the bandleader and saxophonist Jonathan Bechet about Loft Modulation, which is running at the Mezzanine Theater at the ART New York Theaters, and it runs through October 27th. You know, even though the time period is different, it also kind of reminds me a little bit of a recent play that was in New York about Basquiat and all his creations. Such treasures that a lot of people never got to see or hear. Now you're bringing this to life. Jonathan, when you started to play this music, did you start reading up more about this whole loft and what took place? And eventually, this would inspire not only a book, but an NPR series, the Jazz Loft. So a lot of people were aware of that. But how much research did you go into?
Well, we had actually done a, I guess what you would say, like a proof of concept or like something like we ran like four scenes out of this play. Yeah, we workshopped it. Okay, so we workshopped this. Man, what year was that snowstorm? Because the day we did it, it was the first time ever that they closed the subways. So we had this massive snowstorm.
Of course,
snowstorm.
Right? Well, a great way to start.
Yeah. Well, we only did one performance, but we workshopped it for like a week or something like that. And so I had done this 6 or 7 years ago. And in that time, you know, so that was when I was first introduced to it. So in that time, you know, I had like 6 years of just being aware of it. And I tried to like find as many recordings, and you know, like you said, there's 2 tons, and they can't just release all this stuff at once because there's all these contract and copyright stuff, so there's not as much of it out as I wish there was relative to how much was recorded. But in between that time, I definitely checked it out, and a lot of musicians were talking about it, and I think that, you know, this is kind of like the age now of like all of these hidden treasures coming out, because there's all these albums that hadn't been heard before that are on tapes that are coming out and stuff like the Jazz Loft. So it wasn't like a period of intense research, because there was just such a long period between when we workshopped this and, you know, now the present day of doing it. So there was just me like going on a website and like, you know, checking out, and then I'd forget about it. And then I'd be like, oh yeah, the Jazz Loft, let me see. And then I'd, you know, try to find more and more recordings of that.
James, you're an actor and producer, and when you worked with director Christopher McElrone on this, you're putting your trust into somebody else's hand. It's your baby. So how did your relationship, where did you meet Christopher, and how did this develop?
Well, I first met Chris as an actor. He directed me in a play. And
the name of that play was?
What was that play? We've worked together so many times, I don't remember which one. I know the last time we worked together where he directed me was Emancipation, written by Ty Jones, and it was about the Nat Turner slave revolt. And we actually did that at the Audubon Ballroom, which was pretty interesting to do a play about the Nat Turner slave revolt in the room that Malcolm X was assassinated in. And Chris directed that. And but also, I invited Chris to see my work, a reading of a play I had written. And from there, Chris said, wow, I really like your work. You know, we developed a relationship. And over time, a lot of times, if I'll write something and say, Chris, here's my first 2 scenes to this play. Here's my scene to this play. And Chris introduced me to this material. He was working with the writer of the book, Sam Stevenson, wrote the book, The Jazz Loft Project. He did the documentary and all those other things. And Chris pulled me into that project as an actor. And I ended up moving on to another project, acting-wise, but the story just never left me. And so I talked to Chris, I talked to Sam, I got this idea, it won't leave me, I want to write, I want to work on it. They both encouraged me, and then I gave Chris the first 2 scenes, probably about 50 pages. And from there, he was like, wow, you have something here. Let's do it.
And so what's been the comment of someone leaving the theater after a Loft Modulation that has meant the most to you? Sometimes, you know, you hear people talking, or maybe they came up directly to you. What has been the comment that's meant the most?
Well, what meant the most? I was in the bathroom the other day, and I'm at a urinal, and there's a gentleman next to me, an older gentleman, and he just said, wow, this is the best play I've ever seen. This is incredible.
Did he know who you were?
No, that was the beauty of
That's awesome.
And
right?
So he's just telling me, oh my God, this play was so incredible, to the point where, as he was going on and on, I was a bit disappointed when he asked me, how did you hear about this? Because then I kind of sort of had to kill the moment and say, yeah, well, I wrote it.
Yeah, but isn't that fun though?
It was more fun just to hear, and then somebody else in the bathroom chimed in. Oh my gosh. You know, and the other gentleman said he had been in lofts. He doesn't remember if he was in that one, but he had been in lofts in the 60s. And so I would have loved to just hear them.
Yeah, because now it changes the whole dynamic of the conversation when you know you wrote it, as opposed to you're just another audience member, you know.
I just saw this fabulous play and I met the playwright. Yeah. Where did you meet him? In the next urinal.
And it was great. We went outside, he introduced me to his wife and all of that. And it was great. They loved the play. I loved it. But I just loved kind of sort of being the fly on the wall and just hearing that other people got it. Other people enjoyed it. You know, that's the height of it, you know, because in this play, I try not to speak just to the artist and the artist grind. There are people in this loft who are not artists. But the thing is, to me, everyone is trying to matter in whatever way they can. So these musicians have a direct way. I want to matter through my art, through my music, through my statements. But then you have other people trying to matter through their relationship, trying to figure out how to matter. And so to have someone just tell me that on every level they got this, they got that, they loved this, and to tell me that without knowing who I am, so they clearly weren't telling me this to, you know what I mean, make me feel better or to give me a compliment. They were just expressing how good my art made them feel. And that was incredible.
Jonathan, if you had an opportunity to either go back to talk to W. Eugene Smith or Hal Overton, what would you ask them?
Oh, man. I would ask them, I don't know if they could ever really give me, I mean, I don't know if they could ever put into words what I would want to know, but it would just be like, man, tell me the feeling you had when you heard these guys in person, because the recordings, man, there's a filter on a recording, you know, and there's a filter sonically and there's a filter emotionally. And, you know, to actually like be standing in front of some of these guys and hear like the sounds come out of their instruments at that moment. I mean, I would ask them what that felt like. I don't know if they would ever be able to like put that into words, but I certainly would ask, just like describe all the sensations, all the emotions you felt, just like, and not necessarily at that loft. Like I would ask that of anybody who was in the scene at that time and could hear any of these titans, you know, play at the peak of that era. Just like, what did it feel like to stand in front of that? What did it feel like to be surrounded by that at any given moment? Like, can you just describe in detail like what that felt like? And I, you know, that's like trying to ask somebody describe the color red. You know, it's red. That's the best you can ever do. But, you know, maybe I'll learn something for that. That's what I'd ask them though. Like, just what is that experience like, you know?
James, would you want to be invited to the loft?
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting to piggyback on something Jonathan said. It's so interesting that now he speaks of, if people went backwards and met them, they would look at them and encounter them with this reverence. And it's funny with art, sometimes when you care about your craft, you don't even realize in real time the visionary and how ahead of your time you are. And so it's something about just being great and not knowing you're great that still pushes you to not settle for what you're doing, you know? And I don't know. I think if I went back and met them, the first thing I guess I would say is thank you. Just thank you for not just grinding, but grinding in a craft for public consumption, because we are that public that has now consumed it. And so, like, you look at Hal Overton, here's a man who loved jazz music, even when he was at Juilliard, and they wouldn't see it the way he saw it, the potential for it, the future of it, the viability of it. And so here he is at night, jamming and orchestrating, writing out orchestrations for Thelonious Monk at Town Hall, because his daytime job won't let him do it. Right? That's an incredible thing that he's decided, you know what? They won't let me, but I'm going to do it on my time, on my dollar, because I believe in it. You know? And I guess that's the same thing now with a play where, you know, certain institutions may not, for whatever reason, economic viability or whatever, say, well, we can't produce this play. But then one producer saying, well, I believe in it. We're going to do it. We're going to move forward with it. And then just in terms of some of those musicians from the past, well, all artists, you look at, it must have been a time, I think, to go back and to look around and see, because in the play I talk about how many musicians died before 40, because that was a time where, whether it was drugs, whether it was hardship, whether it was mental illness not being seen or treated the way it is now, a lot of these musicians, a lot of these artists were going through it. So we have celebration and reverence for them all these years later. But in a way, it was thankless while they were doing it.
They were normal people.
They were normal people.
They were normal people with gifts and demons and all those things, you know. We can look through it like the lens of like, oh, this artistic greatness. But back then, you know, it's... you know, it's like you said, it could be thankless. It could be like, you could be huge. You could be a big name, but yeah, you were just a normal person at the end of the day, and you were just like getting through every single day, and you were struggling, and you were making not a lot of money. You know, like even though it looks like they were super successful, the amount of money wasn't like that great. You know,
and so sometimes I think, just thank you and job well done.
Yeah,
you know, can go as far as riches, because some of them, what they were chasing was not riches.
Well, they were playing for, they were playing for something, you know, they really believed in it. And, you know, I think, these were guys who were, you know, who believed in what they were doing. And I think that especially as you got into the 60s, you know, there was a growing level of cynicism, yes, in American culture that I think started then and has like really blossomed now. I think there's a lot of cynicism in America right now, and I think it kind of started around that era. And these were guys who were just only playing, you know, every note, it was the note that they really just believed in. And they weren't doing things like cynically or because they had some other motive or something like that, you know. And there's a really great, I don't remember the exact quote, but it was posted in one of the dressing rooms. And it was attributed to the character Myth Williams or you know, whoever. And it said, I'm completely paraphrasing the quote. It said, you know, what if nobody likes this play, or what if nobody wants to see our work? And the response was, well, that doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is that we did it anyways, and that it meant something to us, and that it was important. And that to me is like the ultimate statement of like art, whether it's jazz or theater or any other kind of craft or visual arts. You know, it's the attempt is what matters. You know, it doesn't matter if it's good, it doesn't matter if it's bad, it's that you're doing it, it's that you believe in it, it's that you care about it, and it's some kind of expression that you're trying to put out there. And you know, how people react to it is never up to you anyways, so attempting to play that game is just hurtful. It's poison, you know, for the craft and the art. And that's what I mean by the cynicism of it when I say, you know, we're in a level of cynicism, because it's like I see a lot of things happening that I don't think people are doing things, or they're promoting things, or they're making music in a way that I don't think they really believe in, and I don't think they even care if they believe in it or not. They're just doing it because they see that as the path to whatever way they define success in their heads. And these guys, you know, like all those guys at that time, you know, that wasn't about that. You know, Thelonious Monk, when he got into some trouble and he lost what was back then called a cabaret card, so he couldn't work in any of the clubs, and he just was like, okay, well then I'm just not gonna work. Because he could have moved to another city, he could have just like gave up entirely and done some other kind of music, but he didn't. And he was just like, I'm just gonna keep composing and trying to do record dates. And eventually, you know, there was a landmark case, and J.J. Johnson was actually one of the plaintiffs on it, and they got the cabaret card system removed, and he got his card back, and you know, he was able to play again. And he, after that, he made all these great recordings and played at the Five Spot and had amazing bands. And I think that's like the most of the fruit of Thelonious Monk's work came out after that period of not being able to work. So just imagine that I told you, you know, you couldn't do the thing you love for like 5 years. Would you still keep trying to do it anyways, or would you just move on? I think a lot of people would understandably move on, but if, you know, you really cared that much, it wouldn't matter that you weren't able to make money off of it or survive off of it. You would just do it anyways.
And it was those times, because yeah. What you just described with the cabaret card, Muhammad Ali did right. The same thing
right.
When his boxing license was taken away. And I think it's just something about, if you hone your craft and play your joy and your pain and you chase possibility, like those four things, hone your craft, play your joy, play your pain, and chase possibility. None of those things are promised. You don't know the end result of it. But if you're true to it and you just get better and good at it, it will strike that chord and resonate. And people will feed off of the truth in that, because I do think there's just truth in that.
A Law of Modulation also features the original piano composition of Grammy nominee Gerald Clayton. Also, before we go, I wanted you to get a chance to mention anything you want about the cast. I've seen Charlie Hudson III several times, and I know he's a brilliant actor. What about the cast should we know?
The entire cast is wonderful, you know. And Charlie Hudson plays a sax player called Sleepy Lou Butler. He's wonderful. There's Elisha Lawson plays a drummer who is very fragile in nature, who was kind of my own amalgam of Sonny Clark, Lee Morgan, and Charlie Parker, and just the demons that they were chasing. The piano player, Wei Tonaver, is played by Eric T. Miller. P.J. Sosko plays the photographer, Myth Williams. You know, they're all wonderful. Buzz Roddy, a veteran actor of many years, many stages, Broadway and other places, plays a police officer in both time periods, because this play takes place now in 2019 and 21st century with a person that discovers the archives, and in the 1950s and 60s. And there's one cop that plays in both eras. There is a character, Kevin Cristaldi, plays the character who finds the archive. And here's a man who is not of the arts, but is inspired and motivated and moved by the arts to chase his own mattering and significance. And at a time when he's going through a hard patch with his wife, Julia Watt plays his wife. And then the last character is Christina Toth and Spencer Hamp, who play characters every day, regular characters, actually a prostitute and a character who gets caught up in the drug scene and becomes a drug addict. And so there are other characters. It's a world that I've tried to create, not just of artists and musicians, but of everyday people who cross their paths, who are in their lives, and who are motivated, whether it's positively or negatively, by the experience of chasing dreams thanklessly, you know, without a spotlight.
Time's running out. Aloft Modulation runs through October 27th at the Mezzanine Theater at ART New York Theaters. We want to thank our guests here on the WBGO Journal, the playwright James Jorsling and saxophonist and band leader Jonathan Bechet. Gentlemen, the excitement, we can hear it, we can feel it in you. We're looking forward to more people enjoying Aloft Modulation.
Thank you. And I'd like to say that people can get tickets by going to the website, which is theamericanvicarious.org. Theamericanvicarious.org. And I believe that there is a code that will allow them to get discount. The code is WBGO.
Yep, it's 35% off. When you're checking out, you can just put in the code WBGO. It'll take it off the shopping cart and you can come see the play for a discount, which, you know, I really, really hope you guys do because I love it. And I think everybody involved really, really loves it. And, you know, I think that that's kind of like the best part of any kind of performance is like seeing something that everybody has put so much love and care into.
Congratulations to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.